So on top of that English Civil War, which was this early bourgeois revolution, not often recognized as such, but I think Matt made a good case for why we should consider it a sort of conflict in a larger sense between classes politically and economically at this time. We have another revolution, of course, the French Revolution, which we've talked about before on this show, and a character by the name of Henri Saint-Simon who arises and has some pretty utopian socialist ideas about how things should be organized.
Yeah, because the French Revolution itself opened the door to a lot of ideas about what that should mean, which were slowly over the course of the conflict pushed down like the gravy chute until it all ended up being about France as a nation. And that ended up being sort of the pervading ideological remnant of the French Revolution. By the end of it, getting through the, you know, the digestive tract of history, what came out, what was really resonant, was like the first modern nationalism,
civic nationalism.
All the other stuff kind of went away, and there were a bunch of strains of it. And one of the most the guy that I always think about is my boy Gracchus Babeuf.
Babeuf, baby. Yep.
Who in the cynical Directory period after the Thermidorian reaction, attempted to bring together disaffected Jacobins for a coup that would institute total social equality on the basis of agricultural land redistribution.
There you go.
But then he got his head cut off.
Yeah, he could not get the sans-culottes, like the nascent working class of that time, to create a proletarian army to get on his side. And as often happened then, he met Madame Guillotine.
Yeah.
Babeuf very much inspired Henri Saint-Simon, who becomes a sort of theorist of this mentality, a theorist of the kind of, you know, proto-ideology that Babeuf was talking about. Saint-Simon broke up society, this is interesting, into two factions, right? It wasn't bourgeois and proletarian, but it was, on the one hand, the idle, all right? So the idle rich, the landlords, the aristocracy on the one hand, and the producers on the other, right? Which included not just workers and not just farmers, but in his sort of ideology, also bankers who worked for their money, also capitalists who worked for their money, and obviously merchants as well. But this is an early class politics where, similar to the diggers before, they started to see these class antagonisms working themselves out in society. And Saint-Simon, with this early class politics, basically wanted a producer's society where everybody worked, where everybody could be either a farmer or a banker. I don't know how you'd figure out which you would end up being.
I mean, it seems like when you ask all the kids who wants to be one, yeah, it's like the guy who gets to sit on his ass and the guy who has to stand behind a donkey.
Yeah.
The one who has to stand in front of an ass, the one who gets to sit on one. I think I know which one most people are going to pick.
Yeah, I'd say so. It is also there's a bit of a digression, but the ideology that he's pointing to is actually also reminiscent of fascism.
Yeah.
Because fascism is a producerist sort of ideology, right? It says that there are the people who actually work, which includes the capitalists and also the workers on the one hand. Then there's the alien, foreign, international finance capital that were, you know, that has to be excluded
it's
from the
really
organic material community.
It's really weird how the country that got the first civic nationalism in Europe is also the one where fascism got its earliest, as we've talked about in a previous episode, from Saint-Simon to
Charles Bourret.
And Boulanger.
Yep.
Like that is why the real rejoinder to like anyone who wants to claim that there's anything unique about the German character.
Oh, yeah, the Sonderweg.
The Goldhagen thesis, that there's anything unique about German culture, is that all of the stuff that went into fascism found its earliest expression in France, which was the first nation of Europe.
And then it's interesting because that, too, kind of breaks down with that old tripartite division between England's political economy, France's politics, and Germany's philosophy. Like, it seems like even with fascism, France, even though it's facing a lot of the same developmental tendencies, tends to have like its finger on the political possibilities of capitalism way earlier than other countries do.
Yeah. Which, I mean, if that holds, then that's relatively encouraging since they're in the middle
Vive
of
le gilet jaune.
They I mean, I got to give them credit. I was even at the height of it. I'm like, they're going to get bored. And now they're not getting bored. They're still doing it. It's they're incredible. Occupying a Blackstone headquarters.
Yeah. That was so fucking good. Yeah. I'm sorry. Blackstone was going to profit off of the elimination of railroad workers' pensions. And so the French workers, thank you, French proletariat. You're so good. Instead of going out and blocking railways, which would be fine, they went to the fucking headquarters of BlackRock. They lit fires in front of it and they shut it the fuck down. That is class consciousness. And yes. Maybe, as you said, France was first, and maybe France will be the first ones to get us out of this fucking mess. Inshallah. Let's talk about another Frenchman, actually. Charles Fourier, a man who, unlike Saint-Simon, who merely contemplated a class society and how that operated, Fourier believed that he could confront it. He had reason on his side. He was an Enlightenment thinker. He said, if I can merely design, this is where we really get into utopian socialism, merely design this purposive way that we could organize a small community, a small commune of workers, right? We could work our way out of capitalism. We could basically show the way forward for a labor phalanx that would get us past the divisions of capitalist and worker and create socialism on Earth.
Yeah, because the thinking in before we had an industrial working class to work with is, since there is no force that could be plausibly brought against society, there is only an alternative model. You build an alternative model, and then people will come.
Right.
And then they will literally...
I have the best plan. And it's
then,
a plan.
And then by virtue of showing it, people will move towards it, and existing structures will simply collapse due to their inability to compete.
And it comes out of the brain of one man like Fourier, who basically puts the workers in barracks together. He sets up a very hierarchical structure of who supervises and who actually works. There's central control in this, right? And labor is literally, in his sort of communal socialist imagination, is literally a phalanx, which is, of course, as we know, the old, you know, Greek fighting battalion, right? Where everybody is all in a line and everybody is closely packed together and everybody is, you know, marching to the beat of the same drum. He saw a very ordered, centralized way of breaking the distinction between those who essentially owned and those who worked on the other side. Mm-hmm. But it was out of one man's head. That's the interesting thing. That's the utopian socialist aspect of it that we start to see more and more, is it's not that there is a working class that starts to self-organize itself and find its own particular interests.
Right.
It's that a enlightened despot essentially could come down, create the best possible plan, give it to the people, and it will be copied because it is, by Enlightenment reason, the best way to organize a society.
Right, because I sat down and I thought this through, you fucking dumb. You dumb hillbillies. Yeah. You stupid just peasant bohunks and working class dumbasses.
And because of the paternalism that I show within this, you're clearly going to want to come live in my labor phalanx.
Yeah, who doesn't want to be in the phalanx?
I'm already telling you, by having these well-worked out plans about how society should run your ass, that you should be coming to live in my labor phalanx.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, we can make fun of it now, right? Because it seems absurd that like people would go from their like nice close knit peasant communities where they can like grow some of their own food and like live in this tight web of, you know, social bonds that they have, and go into live in a labor phalanx, you know, or the same thing with a working class person in Paris. But it is a real innovation. And it shows at this time in the early 19th century that people are seriously considering the contradictions and the conflicts within capitalism and trying to figure out a way out, right? Yeah. Fourier sees, and later Robert Owen, who we'll talk about in a second, they see that the system such as it is, this Dickensian capitalist industrial system, cannot last. We cannot continue to do this because of not just the poverty and the misery, but the antagonisms that exist between the classes.
Yeah, but what they were dreaming of, and I think the central fantasy that Marx decided was the fault of it and needed to be confronted, was the idea that any of this could be resolved without conflict.
Right.
Because all of the pre-Marxist socialists, at the end of the day, and the reason he would call them utopians and all, and get very angry at them, is because the mechanism for changing society was always involved something that elided the actual conflicts between classes.
Yes.
Because the implications of a class operate, you know, rising up, were too destabilizing and terrifying, especially for people who were not, who did not see the revolutionary potential for people, but who saw them as clay to be molded.
Exactly.
Like when you're trying to organize people into a labor phalanx and impose that on them for their own good, you certainly don't have any trust that they themselves could make their own history, make right. their own changes, make their own society.
And when you see the flip side of it that we're talking about here with this utopian socialism, you know, you can understand how Marx and Engels and then people later on were so revolted by this because of the paternalism of it, because of the top-down and hierarchical nature of what these people were proposing, because it gave no agency whatsoever to normal-ass people, right? Yeah. To the masses of working people at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robert Owen. I want to talk Robert Owen because he's the last one of the big three. There's Simone, Fourier, and Owen.
And
so
Owen really put his literal money where his mouth
literally,
was.
Literally, he busted himself. He busted folks.
Yeah, he did. He busted all over everybody.
He had a bunch of textile mills in New Lamarck. Was it in Scotland or was it in Wales or is it England?
England?
It's one of those. Somewhere in Britain. Somewhere we don't really differentiate between those cursed isles. But Owen ran factories. Owen was a textile capitalist. And he was clearly a very sensitive man and a very good and philanthropic man. And he saw the conditions that people lived under. He got a lot of his workers from workhouses in the surrounding area. So very, very poor people. He saw how difficult childcare was for them. He saw they had no means of social welfare. He saw that the other capitalists in England at this time were forcing people to work 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a week. And he said that this is unsustainable. We can no longer do this. So he sets up his New Lamarck factories as an early example of what we'd later call welfare capitalism, mm-hmm. right? This Fordist conception of a happy worker is a productive worker. If people have enough to live off of, they're going to do better for you. And this model that he creates becomes very popular, not just in Britain, but also all over Europe, as capitalists and politicians are trying to figure out a way to stop the class conflict and the dire poverty.
The way to keep the money coming in out of all of this great unleashed economic potential without the attempt accompanying social dislocation.
Yes.
And alienation that comes with it.
And tuberculosis and all those other shitty things.
Which is what we've been, that's really, you could call, that's basically every strain of mainstream, you know, social, political, scientific thought since then. Fascism is also an element, is also trying to solve that same problem.
Yeah.
Keynesianism is trying to solve that problem.
Yes.
You know, the neoliberalism tries to solve that problem. Like it's trying to create a way to maintain a profit-based system of surplus value being appropriated without
the attendant consequences.
Yes. They want all the groceries in one bag and they want the bag to be light.
That's right.
And that's what every major innovation in political economy has been an attempt to square that circle.
And that's important to point out because we're now in the 18-teens and the 1820s. We're in full capitalism now, baby.
Oh yeah.
Like nobody can deny
the satanic mills are
humming. Oh man. Charles is writing the Dickens out of some fucking novels right now. And Fourier and Owens and others are trying to solve it. So Owens, real quick, he transitions from this welfare capitalist model, you know, which becomes popular in the United States later on, to eventually Engels calls him a communist. He essentially becomes a communist. He has this idea of a new, what is it called? I forgot the name. New moral world. There we go.
The new moral world.
How Warren-esque of that. All right. So I looked it up, and Robert Owen has something called the new moral world that he creates. This conception of, again, a way to kind of square the circle, how to have production, but, you know, without conflict. Very utopian socialist sort of way of designing society where you, again, create a community that's based around labor, right?
Yeah.
And he moves beyond that to a kind of communistic conception of, you know, a completely communal property structure where everybody lives, you know, in this particular town. They share everything in common. And the proceeds of all of that get kicked back to the workers. The only real distinction in Robert Owen's new moral world is between supervisors and workers. Again, Owen is doing his best right now to make the best plan. He's like Elizabeth Warren, right? Mm. He's got the best plans out there. He's not relying on a social movement. He's not relying on a movement of workers. He's not relying on political action. Again, like a good utopian socialist, he's getting down there and he's going for it. He's doing it. He goes to New Harmony.
Indiana,
baby, in the Midwest. And he says, I'm going to create this. I'm going to put my son in charge of this. We're going to build a productive community based on communal property arrangements, and we're going to make this work. And you know what happens, folks? It doesn't work.
Damn it.
It falls apart within a few years. Because this is a common problem. As we kind of get to the end here, we're going to see with the sort of back to the land movements of the 1970s. When you sequester yourself off and create a utopian community somewhere in the world, one of your major problems is that you now have this perfectly planned utopia that you've created where things are more equal, where people treat one another better, where you have presumably more stuff because everything's in common. What do you do with the rest of the world? What do you do with the fact that the people outside the gates of your commune don't have the things that you do, and oftentimes, because they live in capitalism, want to have the things that you have and will go and move there and take those things from you? That's a real fucking problem.
Yeah. And also competition.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to be sustaining yourself on the output of your industrial capacity, you have to be competitive in a marketplace.
You have to be capitalist.
Yes.
This is huge. So Owen's community of New Harmony falls apart because a bunch of people from around there come in for the free health care and the free child care. They want to be part of this community, but they don't really believe in it or particularly give a shit about it. And when you have a bunch of like freeloaders and loafers who come from this capitalist society and want to have your communal shit, stuff doesn't really work out. So that falls apart. The instances where, as Matt said, you have a functioning commune, functioning intentional community, which we see all over the United States, especially in the 19th century. There's all this free land to move out on. It's a moment of political and social and economic experimentation in the United States in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. The ones that actually survive are like the Oneida community, which essentially is started by John Humphreys Noyes, who was a religious man. He was a perfectionist. He thought we could create perfection on earth. He basically started another one of these communes in Oneida, New York. And the way that they sustained themselves over time was by creating silverware. In 1877, they started to make communally silverware, very nice silverware. And the only thing that's left of it, because it exists to this day, is not a utopian socialist commune, but a corporation that makes silver. And this is the way the kind of almost inevitable results of all of these communities that are based around production that's communal is they end up turning into capitalist enterprises. And the only thing that's really left at the end of it is a profit-making entity.
Yes.
Which is sad, but, you know, this is the way things go.
Everything gets dissolved. All that is solid melts in the air.
That's right.
Well, it has to, because how are you going to compete?
How can you compete?
Why... As much as it's a useful rhetorical tool, referring to capitalism as a problem of greed is always going to be inaccurate, because the individual desires of any given captive industry are totally meaningless. If they decide to become, if they decide that they're not greedy anymore,
right,
they will be out comparative advantage with someone who is willing to be that greedy, not even on their own behalf, but on the behalf of their shareholders.
And one of the dark secrets of this sort of advanced political economy and theory is that the capitalist is ultimately just as constrained by market forces and capitalist social relations as we are.
Yeah.
They might get more out of it, but they, like Matt said, they can't choose not to be greedy. They can't do a Robert Owens thing. Robert Owen ends up becoming fucking poor by the end of he spends all his money on trying to be not greedy.
Yeah.
And then he's not a capitalist anymore. He's gone for the market.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you look at philanthropic endeavors of a lot of these hyper rich people, and it really does feel like they're trying, obviously, to launder their reputation or their identity or something. But there is a lot of them. There does seem that Owenite spirit of reshaping things. But even they, with their incredible resources, are unable to bend the arc of the economy in any way that is meaningful.
In a $14 trillion world economy, any capitalist is going to be a small fish in a big fucking sea.
Yep. Bezos, what you got $100 billion to get back to me? That's nothing.
You might make it to Mars, but you're not going to change the social system, son.
Yep.
So to end this utopian, because these are the original utopian socialists. These are the big three right here. I want to kind of situate us with what Friedrich Engels says in Anti-Düring, which is about a man named Eugene Düring, who had this sort of positivistic theory that was as similar to what Matt said, relied not on class conflict. Düring believed that the proletariat and the bourgeoisie could all just get along at the end of the day, because he had this advanced scientific theory where human beings were naturally sympathetic to each other, and that conflict didn't have to happen, and that we could create socialism without class antagonism, yada, yada, yada. Engels wrote a whole book about it in Anti-Düring, and he actually attacks Düring, who critiques these utopian socialists, because Düring says that Saint-Simon, Owens, and Fourier are social alchemists, right? They're going out there and they're trying to change the structure of society separate from that society. They're social alchemists. And Engels has the real fucking zinger. He says, well, these utopian socialists, they may be social alchemists. However, in the epoch that they lived, people needed alchemy. Which I think is an incredible analogy, because, of course, as we know, in the late Middle Ages, out of this era of enchantment of the world into a disenchantment scientific positivist world that has all the trappings of modern science, you needed alchemy as this sort of middle phase that you pass through in order to have the scientific method. Engels is saying to Düring, you imbecilic dwarf, which is what he calls him, you needed to have these utopian socialists in order to have scientific socialism.
Yes. The good old the steps, man.
It's the steps, man. It was working it out.
You
got to
work the
ourselves.
Steps. Just like AA.
And I, so after Oneida Community and John Humphrey Noyes and Owen and Fourier. Noyes, by the way, interestingly, he had a Volcel ideology. Do you know about that?
Oh yeah.
He believed in male continence. He called it his theory, his utopian socialist theory. I guess at the Oneida Community was that young men can never bust. You cannot bust. But how do you get yourself to not bust? Is you have to find, there's basically women in the community who have to train the young men not to bust. And who are those women? Because you can't just go make babies willy-nilly. Women after menopause. So in Noyes's Oneida Community vision, young men had to practice with older women in order to become Volcels.
Okay, so they have a lot of sex with presumably women who cannot have kids.
Right, cougars.
And then when they're done,
they can then it's
they
practice
just focus
for them to
on farming or whatever.
No, no, it's even better. It's like they have what do you call it when you don't finish? Coitus interruptus.
Oh, okay.
They never bust.
So you just have the sex, but you don't bust.
Yeah, it's like tantric forever. It's like infinity tantra.
Okay.
Can you imagine that Noyes's Oneida Community fell apart after all this? It's hard to imagine.
Did they have a nutbusters patrol going out there, inspecting the sheets and stuff, making sure that nobody nutted anywhere in the...
It's entirely possible. But you know what? I think that modern incels and people on the alt-right who are trying to figure out sexual relations in these very troubled times, maybe they could take a cue from Noize.
Yeah.
And maybe try to find some cougars who will train them not to bust.
I mean, No Nut November is already a thing, so we can just build off of that.
All year, baby, from 1 month to 12. Yeah. We can do this. So with that, we sort of transition now with Engels anti-Döring and the end of these experiments of the 19th century into what you all know of as the modern socialist movement that is not utopian, that does not rely on people making fancy plans. Socialism, I have a plan for that. Not in the late 19th, from the Paris Commune all the way up to, I'd say, the present moment, right? This idea that socialism is something that has to be created by the working class itself, those people who have an interest in it, has been the sort of dominant ideology, mm-hmm. and I think for good reason. We did, however, maybe 50 years ago, take a little detour for a bit. It was a swinging time in the 1960s. You had a youth of America who was upset by the social order. Not quite capitalism, but the conformity of the generation before them, their goddamn parents. And they started to create a movement of their own. Places like Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. They fought heroically in many cases against the Vietnam War. They fought heroically for civil rights in the 1960s and the early 70s too. And they had a very kind of contrarian, almost Jan Husian vibe about them when it came to social mores. When towards the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s, when that kind of high tide of this rebellious hippie movement had started to recede a bit, there was a gigantic movement. I think the stats are 750,000, so 750,000 people moved from the cities to the countrysides in the United States to start intentional communities. There was a real return after all the defeats of the 20th century towards utopian socialism in the United States. And we can see this importantly in, I think, projects that we need to learn a lot from today that maybe we can model ourselves on. And I'm thinking of a particular movement. They were based in San Francisco. They were based in Los Angeles and outside of it. Charismatic gentleman who was able to pull people under his fold and do good and powerful and important things and also have a real impact on the world. And I'm talking, of course, about Charles Manson and the family, right?
Oh, that's how you do it.
That's how you do
it. Get everybody completely whacked out on acid and then murder some celebrities.
That's right. Brainwash the shit out of them and... create Andy, what's the name of the thing, the ideology that he had? Charles Manson?
Helter Skelter?
Yeah, Helter Skelter.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, then there was also the weird environmentalist one. Well, we're all Charles Manson truthers here. We all believe that the CIA actually set him up on that it was all an inside job. But.
Well, I mean, he was definitely, I mean, having read Chaos, it's hard to not come to the conclusion that he was
great
being
books,
run.
Folk. Yeah.
He was being run and he was being used as like an MKUltra petri dish. Beyond that, I don't know. But yeah, he did not just come up with that idea by himself.
But it's interesting because Charlie Manson becomes the sort of villain, for good reason, in American eyes. We don't actually stand Charlie. But like, of what happens when in the 1960s and 70s in the United States, American kids open themselves up to these sort of utopian visions of like this grand plan, this like freeing of social norms and social bonds that, you know, is this recurring theme throughout world history, right? And of course, like the lesson is supposed to be that if you do that, you're going to end up killing unborn babies and like actresses and shit. But he was part and parcel, the most kind of demonic end of this back to land sort of hippie communal movement that arises in the United States towards the end of the 20th century. I think that was this revival that was trying to confront the failures of, say, Soviet communism, uh-huh. of social democracy in the United States. It comes back in the United States in a big way. 750,000 people going to live in these new sort of intentional communities.
Because how the diggers sort of fled the failure of the Leveler movement, this is fleeing the failure of the student movement. And sort of in a similar sense, you could say that like their ideology, obviously not a lot of them were Puritans. They weren't like Calvinists the way that the diggers were. but they were, in a similar sense, unable to conceive of a left movement occurring because they were not part of one.
Right.
Like, they were largely the children of the relatively affluent middle class. A lot of them had spent the years of protest sort of trying to hit the working class with a stick and get them to get on their side. And I mean, obviously the idea that the working class was like reactionary is not really true,
no.
But they certainly were not mobilized and militant in the way that the students wanted them to be.
Right.
And so with that, with the hope of the working class like arising from their slumber, not coming to fruition, that left the old pre-working class idea. Like, if that's a doomed enterprise, then all we can do is try to model alternatives ourselves
and create harmony in the world.
Yes.
Because their vision initially comes from an anti-war sort of civil rights background, they expected a lot more of the American working class, which was very much tied up with the big institutions of labor and the Democratic Party in this time, than the working class of the United States, it turns out, was willing to actually give.
Yeah.
So this comes out of, I think, a real disappointment on the part of a lot of, you know, socialist militants at this time, that they could not have ultimately what they really wanted by the, you know, high point of that movement, which was a socialist revolution in the United States. So what better to do then to create a nice plan to work together with your friends and try to create an ideal living circumstance that's away from and excluded from the rest of that society, where you can show to those normies out there in the cities that this is the way that you can actually live. This is the way that you can create a more harmonious and peaceful sort of society.
Yes.
And like I said, hundreds of thousands of people did that. What you saw, though, and again, this is the running theme, is that not only was it domesticated, you know, by that, like, competition ruins a lot of these communes that exist, right? It basically turns them into capitalist enterprises. But this entire movement ends up, in a larger sense, being kind of pulled back into the American ideology of, like, the Wild West. You know, this idea of, like, people going off and doing their own thing and going their own way. The individualism that exists in American society couldn't be overcome, it seemed, by this sort of communal movement where people are going to live together, share their property, you know, go by their own rules. And within maybe 5-10 years, almost every single one of these communes created in the 60s and 70s was gone, mm-hmm. or turned into a capitalist enterprise. There's a great example. It's still around to this day. It's called The Farm. And in 1971, this group of hippies, they left, of course, San Francisco, and they went out and got 1,700 acres of land in Tennessee. And they decided socialism's not happening in San Francisco. We're good hippies. We're going to go make this happen. They banned alcohol. They banned tobacco. They banned private property. They said that the only real sacrament of their community was marijuana and LSD. You know, the makings of a really good plan so far. They got everybody to live together in tents at first in very, very dire sort of circumstances. But there was this vision, this kind of ferment, these hippies from San Francisco, to create a new world, right, in the shell of the old, that they lasted for many, many years. Until, of course, by the 1980s, more and more, you saw the same thing happen. More and more people were coming from outside of the community, using up their services. They started to have an us versus them sort of mentality about the rest of the world. They ceased to see themselves as a model for everybody else. They saw themselves as antagonists, and they became eventually a molasses company. They no longer had the same sort of communal laws and strictures on the books. They decided to dissolve themselves from this, you know, hippie socialistic commune into essentially a landholding property corporation that also sold molasses products on the side. And they still exist to this day. But is that utopian? Is that the utopian socialism that you want coming out of the farm? I'm not sure.
Because that will always happen because, as we said, you've got this... If it's operating at the same time as this other system, people who are fully inculcated in capitalism are going to come, and you know the process, it's basically entropy. You know, it's like just osmosis. But the energy is going to eventually get just seeped out of it. But beyond that, is the fact that if you're trying to the one of the real powerful things about capitalism, as a not necessarily even as an economic system, but as a hegemonic ideology, is that it buries so much of it, the inherent antagonism between people and between classes, under like the structure of legality. And so if you're trying to operate a commune where everything is communally owned, well, how do you determine who gets what for what point of time? Everything becomes a democratic conflict that has to be resolved through some sort of discussion or argument, some draining thing. If things are owned, then that goes away.
It's implicit.
The conflict doesn't go away.
Right.
But the way to resolve it goes away. This is mine. If somebody touches it, I'll call the cops.
Right.
And that's simple. And then that's all. And of course that's the violence that underlies the entire thing. That's the violence that keeps the system going. But it's sublimated away from the actual conflict between people. Like, I don't have to argue with you about who's going to use the thing. I have a thing saying I own it.
Right, right.
I just call, and the cop can talk to you about it. I don't have to get involved.
And even if you don't have to take the deed out to show you that I own this jewel pen right here, right? You grow up in a society where it's simply implicit that if you own something, it's yours and nobody else can touch it.
Yeah.
And how in the process of creating a commune by moving to 1,700 acres in Tennessee can you, in this small group of maybe several hundred people, get past all that conditioning that exists? Even if you want to create the most perfect society, I think that we've seen, not just in this history, but in all histories, the only real acid that can confront the acids of capitalism that dissolve all these social relations is something you can call a revolution, I guess. A great upsurge and a great upturning where all of a sudden people start to make their own rules and start to make their own new sort of ways of arranging society. And that's a very different process, you know, this radical mass movement of people confronting and fighting the powers that be. It's very different from sitting down with a dozen people and deciding the perfect way, the perfect plan, like Elizabeth Warren, to create a society.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What is under considered when people think about this stuff is the degree to which, ideally, obviously, experiences have differed through different historical elements. Historical periods because of, the conditions. It's a collaborative process, but it's a collaborative process by a mass of people who are expressing themselves simultaneously. And what they're building is something that is a counter-hegemony and that doesn't allow... There's nowhere to go. Like, that's a big component of it. It's because... If you don't want to be part of a social order that like requires a certain degree of investment, the lure of going of appealing to the sort of the sleepwalking nature of a capitalist system where things just sort of are enshrined and then go seemingly without human intervention is always going to be there if it exists. That's why it has to not be there as an alternative.
Yeah, people kind of have to face with sober senses the real conditions of their existence, and nothing does that like a mass upsurge of people confronting the social order. And we've seen this over and over again. Again, like in the Protestant Reformation, like that's what it was. People were expressing themselves in completely different terms. But I think that this effort at negation is a very important thing. Like you see it in Big Rock Candy Mountain, this sort of negation of the class society of the 1930s in a post-work, post-scarcity type society where a bum can be a bum, right? Can live as an actual bum. That negation even exists within these utopian socialist communities of the 60s and 70s. They want to be a commune. They want to not be alienated. They want to not be separated. They don't want private property, right? It's this sort of urge, this instinct that's kind of imminent within human society all through time. And I think that one hope that we have is that for 2,500 years, we've seen in various sort of iterations this human desire to get past hierarchy, to get past exploitation and past domination. It might be a bunch of fucking hippies sitting on a farm in Tennessee. It might even be Occupy, right? So Occupy happened only, what, fucking 10 years ago? Yeah. Less than that now, right? Occupy is an interesting theme because so many people want to shit on Occupy. I was very, very much involved in New York City, Occupy Wall Street. I was down there all the time. Andy was down there too. Many of my friends and comrades were down there doing our thing down at Zuccotti Park, right? It's almost like after the long, long slumber, after the long, shitty sleep of the death of the anti-globalization movement of the 1990s into September 11th, which basically puts the brakes on any sort of left activity, all the way through to the giant fiscal crisis of 2007 to 2008, there was this long slumber of sort of left activity in the United States. When Occupy Wall Street came around, it not only popped off in New York City, much to everybody else's surprise, but then it pops off in countries and towns, I'm sorry, cities and towns all over the country and all over the world at that point in time. And it was very much a utopian socialist concept that said, if we all come together, right, if we all come in common purpose, we reject the world such as it is, and we try to build in this park, in this space, a new form of society based on non-hierarchy, based on consensus, based on radical democracy, that we can, through this mechanism, show that a different world is possible, another world is possible, that good old, you know, 1999 WTO thing, you know, we are unstoppable, another world is possible. People shit on Occupy Wall Street, and I think for good reason, because it was definitely cringe as fuck. Like, we all recognize now, looking back 8 years, that Occupy Wall Street, I'm sorry, but it was a little bit fucking cringe, right? The clapping and the people's mic and the dreadlocks and all that shit.
The bongos. That
the
was a
bongos.
Big thing.
Jesus Christ. Bro, you're posting cringe. I mean, I think we all recognize that now. But I would argue that, and this is kind of my separate thesis to the, you know, there's this latent sort of utopian impulse within human beings. Another thesis I have is that it's not merely, like Marx and Engels said, that utopian socialism is insufficient ultimately. I think that there's a part of human beings and part of human social movements that needs a sort of dialectic between the hope that this utopianism brings and the immediacy of the community that that brings. And that community is basically an expression that thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of other people feel the same way that you do and are willing to engage in a practice that shows that you are in solidarity with one another, right? That sort of utopian drive has to exist alongside a more scientific, for lack of a better term, sort of judgment of class forces and class relations and how we move forward and confront them politically. You need the utopian in a sense because maybe it keeps us honest.
Well, you need it for the simple reason that it requires a utopian mindset to even ask, even say that there's an alternative way.
Right.
When you're living in an era like post 9/11 of the United States.
Yeah.
Which, having lived through it, I could tell you was absolutely.
It was shit.
The absolute zenith, even more than the 90s in a way, of the Tina nonsense, the concept.
Oh, my God, yeah.
The idea that we had reached the end stage.
Because there was no alternative. It was combined with this war fervor that just pushed down and suppressed any sentiment whatsoever against it.
So you had, because it's like, obviously everyone likes to joke that, you know, Fukuyama said there was no history, and then 9/11 happens, like, oh, I guess history's back. And yes, history was back, but not in the sense that there was going to be any kind of evolution economically, just the sense that maybe the whole world isn't going to become, you know, a globalized free trade zone.
Right.
But this part will defend itself against the part that refuses to be absorbed into the collective.
It was relatively explicit that empire was back.
Yes.
Right? That we need to become an empire. In that sense, history was back.
Yeah.
Not in a good way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And if anything, like it became this vacuous neoliberalism becomes a fighting creed, which is really horrifying and obscene, I mean, considering just how empty it was. But it was what we had, and nobody really had any way of saying it. And that's the thing. It's like the Occupy people were willing to post cringe to suggest that things didn't have to be this way.
Right.
And you have to have had a certain degree of your, your practicality removed to make that leap, to say I'm willing to say this, because if you are practical, It's like, what's the point of even talking about anything? What's the point of having politics?
Occupy was not going to take over the city centers of the entire United States. I think even at the time, everybody knew that. But yes, you needed, you know, a kick in the ass to get out of that quiescence of that particular period.
Especially post-Obama.
Yeah.
Because we had the total rout of the left after 9/11. Then you had the collapse of 2008 and the people souring on Iraq and this moment where a charismatic con artist, a snake oil salesman, rolled into town and figured out a way to be everything to everyone and embody everyone's disparate disenchantments with the current order, promise an alternative, but actually just use that campaign as a way to get, like, long-term, hang out with Richard Branson, get a Netflix deal.
Windsurf.
Like, that's literally the entirety of his... Yeah. That's what's so breathtaking
about
it.
Yeah, it's incredible.
The entire... Yeah. Like, he did this. He single-handedly derailed the entire, like, anti-capitalist, anti-establishment energy that was created by the 2008 economic collapse and destroyed it on purpose in order to become president. And then just hang out.
Yeah.
No, not like Nixon. We were talking about Nixon in a previous episode. Like Nixon did what he did. He did Watergate. He did wage and price controls. He got rid of the Bretton Woods system.
He's a man of his era.
He did whatever it took because he thought he was the only president who could negotiate America's entry into a multipolar world. He saw the end of American hegemony, and he said, America will not be able to call the shots anymore. China's rising. We're declining. We're energy vulnerable, so there's going to be a multipolar world, and I want to get America the best deal. And he was a sociopath and a monomaniac, but he was at least powered by this great destiny.
Right.
He was going to do this. Obama, none of it.
None of it.
No, didn't care. Just wants to hang out with
fucking
celebs.
Fucking cynical. Completely. Even used in 2008 the language of movement politics in order to create what? Nothing.
On purpose.
Absolutely not. And he knew it.
He knew it.
He was deflating that bubble on purpose
so
he could run as a meritocratic neoliberal fucking jerk off in the White House.
And then, he got in there and his immediate message to everyone was, yeah, you know all that shit you were really mad about where they just bailed out the banks who did all this? That's happening.
Yeah, we're doing more
of
that now.
You actually can't vote against this. You know a lot of you did, but guess what? You can't. You can't vote against this. This is just the way things are.
There is no alternative.
Spiking of the basketball there. And so you had to be out to lunch in certain critical factors to say, you know what? I'm going to stand naked in a fucking park in downtown New York and insist that there's an alternative.
In 2011, the second fucking term of this horrendous, disgusting, cynical presidency, yes, you needed to get a little fucking crazy. And I would argue, and I think hopefully persuasively, that you could not have this nascent rising socialist movement right now, you know, all around the United States, millions of people who are learning and organizing right now for a different world, for socialism. You could not have that if you had not burst the bubble, if you had not said in 2011 that there is an alternative. Actually, it wasn't that alternative, but it was a alternative.
You could say what Engels said about the utopians.
Yes.
This is a society that needed alchemy.
Exactly.
Class politics had been extinguished.
Folks, you heard it here first. Occupy Wall Street was social alchemy, and we needed it in that transitionary phase moving forward. So I hope that, you know, we went through this history. I hope that we didn't shit too much upon utopian socialism and this sort of utopian strain, because I really do think there's a dialectic between the possible and the impossible.
Yeah.
And we're living in a moment in time where hopefully it seems like we'll get something more utopian than dystopian. And granted, it was 65 degrees today in January in New York City. So dystopia is, it seems kind of hard to imagine right now. But the stakes are really fucking high. And as Matt mentioned earlier, right, it's really nice to create a good and coherent plan about the best sort of world and society you want to live in if you separate yourself from the rest of the world and go live on a farm or in the desert somewhere, right? But pretty soon now, with climate change and with the increasing crises of this capitalist system, it's more and more clear there is no outside anymore.
Yeah.
We are all going to have to face social breakdown, complete calamity in the climate. So there doesn't seem to be any more escape now from actually together collectively confronting and maybe being a little utopian about our future as humanity.
Yeah, because you can't. If you try to do Back to the Land again, you better pick the land well.
And better be on high ground.
And even if you do, then Tom Savini is going to show up with his biker gang and just take it.
That's it.
And so we have to maintain a social order. It just has to be a human one for the first time.
And it simply cannot be every man and woman for himself. Like, I think we're kind of learning this as this slow crisis kind of continues, is that this idea that we're all going to make it as, like, individual bourgeois nomad individuals out in this world, that just ain't going to cut it, folks. No. And I think that it's not just socialists. And I think you see this in history, too, that there may be people with the idea that the world could be different, but even folks who aren't declared socialists are going to hopefully start understanding that things can simply not go on as they were, as they have been. And maybe, you know, some of these experiments that we've seen in the past and the experiments that people are doing today in, I don't know, anarchist spaces and movement spaces elsewhere, maybe they'll be useful for us in the future. So let's not completely shit upon utopianism. We need that sort of element to fight dystopia.
Right. But also, you need to be able to recognize when movement does come along that, like, joining it and doing what you can is more important than expressing yourself.
Yes.
Put it that way.
The bongos will only take you so far, folks. You can still have the dreadlocks, but you do have to fall into a larger movement and get organized.
Absolutely.
Because we have a giant historical task in front of us.
Indeed.
All right. Thank you, folks. We're signing off.
Bye.
Growing up won't mean a thing. Oh, where are the youth? We need you now. Come speak the truth.